people to know who you are. In addition to me, we have Dr. Janice Free Newell, who is a sociologist who focuses specifically on criminology and criminal justice. She is a professor at Emmanuel College, which is a Catholic college in downtown Boston. But the more important thing you should know about Janice is that she is a very dear friend of mine. We have been friends for 15 years at least, probably. We both go to the same church. We go to Park Street Church in Boston. And so before we get started, I kind of want to tell you how she and I got here and then how we got here. My church, our church, Park Street, this winter hosted a couple of panels on kind of popular topics and faith, and I was asked to speak on a couple panels on sexual harassment and faith in that intersection. And Janice and I just happened to have lunch. We didn't plan to talk about this, but we happened to have a lunch scheduled the day before the first panel. And so I was sort of bouncing some things off of her, and we ended up having this really long discussion about sexual harassment. This is something she studies professionally. And we just thought, this might be a helpful combination, a helpful way to come at this topic. Janice is going to be talking tonight primarily from the perspective of a researcher and of a statistician and of a teacher. I'm primarily going to be coming at this from a theological context. We're both coming at this as Christians. We're both coming at this as women. So that is where we are tonight. Just a couple of not warnings, just things I want to flag before we get started. This is a heavy topic. This is a heavy lecture. This is going to be a heavy lecture. We're going to be talking about some hard and heavy things. I am just going to go ahead and assume that the majority of the women in this room have some sort of experience at minimum with sexual harassment. I know for a fact that there are other people who have experience with more than that. And some of the men in the room may have that experience as well. So once we move to discussion time, I want you to keep that in mind as we talk to one another, that this is a very personal issue for a number of people. So we want to be sensitive to that. I also just want to say that Janice and I are not in any way being gratuitous in what we're sharing tonight, but we will, Janice especially, be just talking very bluntly about some of these things. She's going to be defining terms. And we feel like that's really important. One of the trends that happens around sexual assault and sexual harassment is the language that's used to describe it is often minimized. We don't talk about sexual assault or rape. We talk about sexual misconduct, which sounds like not that big of a deal. And it's a really important thing to name things, to call them what they are. We don't want to do that in an extreme way, but we want to be truthful and honest about how we're talking about things. So that's where we're coming from tonight. all right. So I think that's all the disclaimers I have for you. The one other thing I wanted to say is that we are primarily coming at this lecture tonight. We are primarily going to be talking about sexual violence against women. But we absolutely know, we'll talk about this a little bit, sexual violence also occurs against men. It occurs against children. And it also occurs in some ways in disproportional rates to people of color, to refugees and immigrants, to people in lower socioeconomic situations, for people in the lesbian, gay, bisexual community. So we just want to acknowledge that as well. This is not an issue that is specific to women. That's where most of the research is. That's where most of the work is done. So that's kind of what we're talking about tonight. There's more we're not going to say than we actually are going to have time to say tonight, but I just want to put that out there as well. Okay. So where we're going tonight, I'm going to do kind of a brief introduction for us, and then I'm going to turn it over to Janice, who's going to share some things from the research side, and then she's going to hand it back over to me, and I'm going to talk about things from the theological side. And we definitely want to have time and space tonight for discussion and questions, but we would ask that you just save all your questions to the end. Otherwise, I don't think we'll ever get through the lecture if we stop when she's done talking. Okay. Okay. So most women can tell you a story about sexual harassment. Not every woman, but most women. I don't think I know any woman who couldn't. On the other side of that, most men, when they hear about sexual harassment and sexual assault, say, that's not me. And so if you think about those two statements, the math doesn't really add up. So there are either a very small number of men committing the majority of sexual violence, or it's a larger number of men, some of whom are in denial or lying, or some of whom don't realize that it's something that they've participated in. although all this talk about sexual harassment may seem like news to some people, I know this has just blown up in the last 18 months in the United States. It seems like where did this come from? It's nothing new. This is nothing new. I remember shortly after the Harvey Weinstein case broke, I was talking with Ben, I think. We were just chatting, and he just asked me, he was like, what do you think about this? How are you reacting to this? And I told him, I was like, I have two reactions to this. One is, I want to put my fist through a wall. It makes me so angry. And the other reaction is like, yeah, I'm not surprised. I don't know anything. I didn't know anything about Harvey Weinstein before. It's not about him specifically, but to hear these stories of all these women coming forward, that was not in any way a surprise to me. But I know it is for a lot of people. I want to just kind of quickly, this is going to be so quick, I'm so sorry, but I want to quickly walk us through how we got here, how we got to, especially the Me Too movement. So we're going to be talking about reflections on women and sexual assault in the era of Me Too. So I want to give you a brief timeline of what that looks like. It's funny, when I was thinking about doing this, and I was like, yeah, I'll do a timeline. And I was trying to think how I was going to visually represent it, like on a slide. It doesn't fit on a slide. It doesn't fit on a slide. And I'm giving you like the Cliff Notes version of this. So just hang with me. I do have a few slides that'll go with it. But so a clincher of a moment that kind of started the ball. It didn't start the ball rolling from the beginning of time, but that started the ball rolling to where we are now. Was October of 2016, so a little over a year and a half ago. A month before our last presidential election, an Access Hollywood tape surfaced of then-presidential nominee Donald Trump bragging to the camera, which, by the way, he did know the camera was there. This is not a hidden video. He knew the camera was right in front of him. Bragging on camera about the vulgar ways that he has approached and sexually assaulted women. This open admission, coupled by the fact that so many political and religious leaders continued to support him, as well as his subsequent election to the presidency, galvanized many women to stand up and take action. This primarily took the form of the Women's March, which was held in Washington, D.C., and in cities all over the country, and really all over the world, actually. This is not just an American thing. On January 21st, 2017, which was the day after Trump's inauguration. It's one of the largest public demonstrations in the history of the U.S. One of the stated goals of the Women's March was to, quote, send a bold message to our new government on their first day in office and to the world that women's rights are human rights. Empowered by the voices and the courage of so many other women, the Women's March set off a domino effect of women rising up to publicly call out the misogyny that they had been living under for so long. Susan Fowler, who's a woman in her mid-20s, she's a former engineer at Uber, the car ride sharing service, was one of the first people to speak out in a way that had a significant effect. In February of 2017, so just a month after the Women's March, she published a blog post on her own personal blog about the misogynistic culture in top leadership at Uber. And that ultimately led to the firing of the Uber founder and CEO, Travis Kalanick, and about two dozen other executives at Uber. She said, this is Susan Fowler, "The second Trump won, I felt super powerless, and I thought, oh my God, no one's looking out for us. They have the House, they have the Senate, they have the White House, and so we have to take it back ourselves. We have to be the ones doing the work." And I think this is just one quote from one woman, but I think there are many, many women who shared her feelings and her sentiments. And over the course of early 2017, the dominoes slowly began to fall. In April, Bill O'Reilly, who's an anchor at Fox, was fired. There were six sexual assault cases pending against him that the network was negotiating. In June, it was comedian and actor Bill Cosby. And then in early October of 2017, the floodgates really opened. On October 5th, the New York Times published a story revealing a long and systemic pattern of sexual harassment, assault, and rape against women by film and media mogul Harvey Weinstein. Do I have a picture of him? No. I do have a picture of him, just not yet. There were dozens and dozens of women, mostly actresses, who came forward in the days following the article. Actresses Rose McGowan and Ashley Judd were some of the first to speak out, followed by many, many others, some who are household names, others who aren't, but many, many other women spoke out against Weinstein. On October 15th, just 10 days after the Weinstein scandal broke, a friend of the actress Alyssa Milano, she's the one on the right, sent her a screenshot of the phrase, "Me Too," that she had seen somewhere online. Unbeknownst to Milano, the phrase had been coined 10 years earlier by Tarana Burke, who's the woman on the left, who is an advocate for young and minority victims of sexual violence. Alyssa Milano, before she went to bed that night, sent a tweet of her own that said, "If you've been sexually harassed or assaulted, write Me Too as a reply to this tweet," inviting others to share with that label. It wasn't even a hashtag. So she sent the tweet, she went to bed, and when she woke up the next morning, 30,000 people had posted with the then hashtag, Me Too. It's been translated into a myriad of other languages, and this is for sure a global phenomenon. From there, Me Too seemingly exploded, and a movement was born. It became a battle cry and a rallying place for many, many people. Again, not only women, men as well, who had experienced sexual harassment, sexual assault, sexual violence. And at that point, the dominoes started falling much more rapidly. California farm workers took to the streets to bring awareness to the rampant sexual abuse present in their communities. Other big names were brought down as well. CBS and PBS News anchor Charlie Rose, NBC anchor Matt Lauer, actor-comedian Aziz Ansari, actor-comedian Louis C.K., Senator Al Franken, in addition to many others in the world of technology, higher education, government, and more. I cannot even begin. I foolishly thought I could come up with a list of all these people, and we would be here all night. It's really amazing. In November, I'm going to talk about this a little bit more later in the lecture, but another hashtag was born, Church Too, in the wake of Me Too, and I'm going to talk about that a little more later. In December of 2017, Time Magazine, in their annual issue where they used to be Man of the Year, now it's Person of the Year, they named the silence breakers of the Me Too movement as their Person of the Year. This is, on the left, that's actually the cover of that issue of the magazine. And one thing that I want to point out here in the cover, you'll recognize that's the actress Ashley Judd, that's Taylor Swift. This is the woman from Uber who I spoke about earlier. This woman works, she's a farm worker in California, a migrant farm worker, and this woman is a lobbyist in the California state government. But you see here an elbow. And when the cover first came out, people were like, who did they crop out of this? Like, it seems like a bad thing. This is a close-up of the elbow. That is intentional. That elbow belongs to a woman who came forward and shared her story, but did it anonymously for fear of kickback for herself and her family. She did tell her story in the article, but her name has changed and the details of her life are changed. And so Time Magazine included her in the photograph, but just with her elbow showing. And it's meant to symbolize that many, many women and men who have experienced sexual violence as well, but don't have the freedom or the privilege, if you will, to come forward publicly because of what that would do to them. Just an interesting note on this. I don't know if any of you remember, but a couple of days before this came out, President Trump, Donald Trump, was actually their person of the year before, in 2016. And I don't know if you remember, but just before this cover came out, he tweeted that Time had approached him about being the person, he might be the person of the year again. Might wasn't good enough for him. He told them no. They've denied that. Time Magazine has denied that. But it's interesting that before it came out, there was quite a bunch of huff about him being the person of the year, and that this is, in fact, who they chose. And I don't know if that Access Hollywood tape had not been released, if we would be here. So it's quite ironic. In January of 2018, another hashtag popped up, Time's Up. Time's Up is not just a hashtag. It's also an organization, an established organization that works towards organization for legislation and policy change around sexual harassment issues, primarily in the workplace. In January of this year at the Golden Globe Awards, one of the big Hollywood award shows, everyone, including all the women, wore black, which is the first time that's ever happened in the fashion world of Hollywood award shows, all wore black. In solidarity around the Time's Up movement. Since the beginning of this year, there have been a number of other notable men, scandals that have come up. One of the bigger ones was Larry Nassar, who was a physician at Michigan State. And he was the kind of team physician to the USA Women's Gymnastics Program. And he was sentenced earlier this year to multiple counts of sexual harassment and sexual assault over hundreds of girls. And then here's your Harvey Weinstein photo. Today, Harvey Weinstein was actually arrested. This picture's from this morning. He was arrested this morning on charges, on three counts, I think, of rape and sexual assault between two different women. So that is where he is. I don't want to leave it there. So this is also from today. This is a social media post from Time's Up. And this is what they posted in response to him being arrested. Today, a man whose actions were so egregious that they spawned a global reckoning has been taken into custody. Harvey Weinstein shattered the lives of an untold number of women. We stand with them and remain in solidarity with women everywhere who have faced unsafe and abusive workplaces. We look forward to seeing justice prevail. So people often say, why don't women speak up more about these things? The Me Too movement has shown us that when women do speak up, very few people listen. The Harvey Weinstein scandal is extreme, to say the least. But it's an example of one man's systemic patterns, and I think that's the key word with him, is systemic patterns, of harassment and assault of women that were widely known, but just as widely ignored and hushed. Many men came forward saying that they had heard the rumors about him, but did or said nothing. Many of the stories shared publicly in the wake of Me Too also had an element of threat to them. Men threatening all kinds of things if women expose them. Further physical and or sexual harm to the victim or to their loved ones, to children, threatening their children. Public humiliation, loss of jobs, loss of wages, or loss of professional opportunities, etc. We know that this is often the case when children are assaulted as well, that children are threatened if they tell. Power is a really significant factor in sexual crimes. Shanice is going to talk about that more later. And as many women know, even minor harassments, the things that we think of that are minor things, a catcall on the street or unwanted advances at a bar or a party, often and very quickly can turn hostile and threatening when women push back. This gets into the tricky issue of consent. Again, Janice is going to talk more about consent. But we're at a place right now culturally where consent is really the lowest common denominator as to whether any kind of sexual interaction is okay, whether a line has been crossed or not. But because of this atmosphere of threat, consent gets pretty tricky. Women often engage in what men maybe fairly actually read as consensual behavior in order to keep situations from escalating. They smile and they laugh. They say something is fine when it isn't. They don't say yes, but they don't say no. There was a fascinating story on This American Life on NPR a while back about an Australian journalist who was out with her friends one night, I think in Sydney, in a popular area where there are quite a few bars and things. And she was watching the bouncers that sat in the doorway, that sat outside the bars, and how many of them would call out to women, catcall them, slap them on the butt, things like that. And so in the light of day, in her normal clothes, not on a Saturday night, she went back and talked to some of these bouncers just to ask them, like, why do you do that? What's that about? And it was really fascinating. One of the guys that she talked to the most, who she talked to for a long time, really didn't feel like he was doing anything wrong. He was like, you know, it's just for fun. The women like it. They're in groups. It's part of the spirit. It's kind of the flirty spirit of being out with your friends on a Saturday night. And the journalist asked him, well, what do these women do? You know, what do you think they think about it? And he said, oh, they like it. And she said, how do you know they like it? And he said, because they smile and they laugh at me. She went back another Saturday night, and interviewed a lot of the women, stopped a lot of the women who were going out and asked them about this. And every single woman she spoke to, except one, who said she did kind of like it, said they didn't like the behavior. It made them very comfortable, but they smiled and they laughed because they knew if it didn't, it could escalate into something worse. And they'd rather have a catcall or a slap on the behind than something worse. And that is a really common pattern. If you ask most women, it's a really common pattern. As I was doing some research here, I stumbled across a couple of really powerful quotes from the author Margaret Atwood, who is the author of The Handmaid's Tale. I don't know if you guys have read that. It's a very popular show on Netflix right now. I just want to share two of her quotes because they kind of just hit me in the gut when I read them. Here's the first one. Men often ask me, why are your female characters so paranoid? It's not paranoia. It's a recognition of their situation. Here's the next one. Why do men feel threatened by women? I asked a male friend of mine. They're afraid women will laugh at them, he said, undercut their worldview. Then I asked some women students in a poetry seminar I was giving, why do women feel threatened by some men? They're afraid of being killed, they said. I'm going to hand this over to Janice at this very awkward point, because this is dovetailing into some of the more statistical things and research-based things that she is going to talk to us about in regards to this. So, we could not jive our PowerPoints into one, so you just have to. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good evening, everyone. So I'm Janice Free Newell, and as Mary Frances introduced me, I currently work at Emmanuel College as a professor in the sociology department, and my specialization is criminology. And so I teach both in the areas of sociology as well as criminal justice and crime theory and criminology. I came to being a criminologist sort of through a different route that I think is important to mention to you tonight, because it applies to some of my perspective and experiences and how I got to where I am with all of this. I graduated from Northeastern with a criminology degree, master's degree, and then I was an intern for several months at the Department of Correction as a victim advocate. When I finished up my master's program, they hired me as a full-time victim advocate. I did that for a year or so, and there was a shift within the DOC's victim advocate unit. There were a couple of us working there. They hired a couple new people, and I was given all cases for the state of Massachusetts of murdered children and all cases of sex assault, rape, and sexual violence for the state of Massachusetts. And so I was 23, 24 years old, and that was my caseload. So I did that for about 3 years and then decided that I had had enough of that for several different reasons and thought I would get away from it a bit and get out of the trenches. And I went and became a program manager at a domestic violence nonprofit organization. But part of being a program manager meant that I oversaw all of the victim advocates in Dorchester that worked for the police departments, the clinics, the emergency rooms, et cetera. And I was brought in as an advisor on sort of the most severe cases. And so I didn't really get away from it at all. I just got a different version of it. And so with that, I decided I would go back to school. And I didn't know what I wanted to do exactly, but I got hooked on teaching. I always thought I'd go back to being an advocate, but I love teaching. And it's become my passion to try to educate younger adults and students about criminal justice, about crime, about violence, knowing that many of them that I teach want to go on to become advocates or lawyers or police officers in the world. So currently my research focuses on at-risk youth. I also delve into areas of social inequality as it relates to crime and violence. And I've done a good bit of research and teaching in the area of family violence and sexual assault, which is how I'm here tonight and talking about these issues. I think it's only fair to say my style is fairly blunt and somewhat academic and can at times seem unemotional, so my student evaluations say. But I am not an unemotional person. I'm actually quite an emotional person. And what I now know to explain to my students is, if I got emotional about this and if I actually let this sink in and get to me every day, I wouldn't be able to keep doing the work that I do. I've had to learn how to put up the shield and turn it on and turn it off, or else I'd be huddled in a corner sobbing, staring at the walls all the time. That's how depressing this stuff really is, and that's how bad it can really get to talk about people's lives being destroyed by, you know, these crimes and these events day in and day out. It is truly but by the grace of God and Park Street Church and my family and friends that I have kept any bit of a positive outlook on life, that I am friends with men, that I got married and trusted a man enough to match my life with him. It's really hard stuff. And when you've worked in the prison and when you've worked in a domestic violence nonprofit and battered intervention groups and you know the data, it only gets scarier. It doesn't get better. It actually gets worse in some ways. And what TV makes seem is interesting and entertaining, the crime shows, it's so much worse than that. It's just so much worse. So this is not a happy topic. I echo Mary Frances's sort of trigger warning that if it becomes too much for you at any time, feel free to step out of the room, shut your eyes, sing Jingle Bells. I do that sometimes in my head. Whatever works to try to remove yourself from it a bit. But I also encourage you to try to really feel some empathy tonight and try to understand why these crimes take place and how someone can end up a victim. And for me, one of the moments in my life when I realized I was finally getting it and I was finally understanding some of these crimes was when I realized I too could be a victim of rape and sex assault and domestic violence. That could have just as easily been me as it could be anybody else. And it's very easy for us to put distance and say, that's not me, I'm not one of those, and I'll never let that happen to myself. But that's really a false sense of security, because this can happen to any of us. So with that, I think it's always important to start off and talk a bit about terms and definitions, because these terms get thrown around. Mary Frances was talking about some of them tonight, And what I find is the media muddles them all up, and society muddles them all up, and even the church muddles them all up. And so I wanted to at least sort of give you a somewhat clear sense of what they mean and what they represent. So when we talk about sexual violence, that's really sort of a catch-all phrase. That's not a legal term. You can't be charged with an act of sexual violence. That is a societal term to describe any sexual act or attempt to obtain a sexual act by violence or coercion, acts of trafficking a person directed against a person's sexuality, regardless of your relationship to the person. So very broad, very general. Then we have sexual harassment, which is largely what the Me Too movement has been bringing to light and talking about. And so sexual harassment is the unwelcome sexual advances or requests for sexual favors and other verbal or physical harassments of a sexual nature. Most often we think about this happening in the workplace, but it's not necessarily only in the workplace. It happens in public. It happens in private residences, and so it's very multifaceted, even though we're most familiar and often most comfortable with the thought of it sort of in the workplace. That's where we know it sort of to happen. And sexual assault. Sexual harassment can be anything from making sexual gestures to telling a sexual joke, displaying sexually subjective materials, pictures, cartoons, using derogatory terms, sexual advances, verbal advances, etc. Sexual harassment was first considered a crime in 1980 when the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, stated that sexual harassment was in fact a form of sexual discrimination prohibited by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibited employment discrimination based on race and color, sex, etc. And really, this sort of was brought to the limelight in the early 90s when the Anita Hill case came about and the charges she laid against Clarence Thomas, who was a federal judge being considered for a federal appointment at the time. So there's a very clear start date to when sexual harassment became a crime. That's not the case with sexual assault and rape, which we'll talk about in a second. Those have more evolved over a very long time. So one of the tricky aspects about each of these terms is there's no one federal definition. Every one of these differs by state. Sexual harassment is the only one that there is sort of a solid federal definition, but the others, sexual assault, rape, are defined by state. And so what I've tried to do here is give you a sense of what the consensus is as to a definition of sexual assault. So an act in which a person sexually touches another person without that person's consent or coerces or physically forces a person to engage in a sexual act against their will. Oftentimes, there's sort of a debate as to whether rape falls under sexual assault or whether rape is its own category. And you'll see it described in both ways. So most criminologists, sociologists say that rape is a form of sexual assault, but it's a crime in and of its own right. Sexual assault can happen either by a stranger, by someone you know. Most oftentimes it happens at the hands of someone that you know, especially within families. And we know that children are particularly vulnerable to sexual assault, as well as elderly, and especially college-age students, right in around that 17, 18 to 22, 24-year-old range. And then we have rape. So the definition of rape really changed in 2013. Prior to 2013, the vast majority of states had included in their definition by force. Now, what states have recognized is that rape does not have to be by force. It can also be by coercion, manipulation, by threat. That was not included in most definitions until just in the last few years. And so rape is the penetration, some states say, or partial penetration, no matter how slight, of the vagina or anus, with any body part or any object. So a lot of times my students are like, what does that mean, or any object? Any object can mean people can digitally rape someone, so their fingers can be used to rape someone within domestic violence. Offenders have used anything from rulers to baseball bats and all sorts of horrific things to rape women with, including snakes and animals, terrible, terrible things. And so now this is a positive evolution of this definition, is that now we include objects to be considered part of raping someone as well, or the oral penetration by a sex organ of another person without the consent of the victim. So all forms of rape are in fact sexual assault, but not all sexual assaults are rape, right? Because sexual assault is in fact much broader. In terms of when they became illegal acts or crimes, it's really hard to say exactly. If we focus on rape in particular being sort of the most extreme act of sexual assault, until the mid-1800s, men were still allowed to physically chastise or correct or punish their wives in the United States. And that was allowed to be done as long as it wasn't excessive. By the mid-1800s, wife assault had become illegal in several states across the country, though it wasn't prosecuted. Rape of a woman who is not your wife became an offense early on. They have dates back as far as the common law in England, and so that has sort of evolved over time to become what it is. And in addition to that, the modern attention on sort of rape and sex assault really began in the 1970s with the sexual revolution, the women's movement, the civil rights movement. That's when we started to think about it a lot more. And marital rape, so raping of your wife, only became a crime for the first time in the United States in 1976. And it wasn't until 1993 that all states considered a crime to rape your wife.
That
the 1993, all states considered it a crime to commit acts of rape against your wife. So that gives us sort of an idea, an overview on rape and sex assault. When we talk about rape, we often talk about there being several different types of rape. So there's stranger rape, there's marital rape, there's acquaintance rape, there is sadistic rape. Sadistic rapes are few and far between, thankfully, and they are typically the ones that involve torture and rituals of some sort in the rape, and they are the least common. The most common is acquaintance rape and familial rape, meaning domestic partners or rape of children. So another important issue then to talk about is consent, and this is something that it's not as simple as it seems. Again, consent is defined by the state. There's no federal definition of consent. And so depending upon how conservative or liberal your state is, your definition on consent is going to change. So Massachusetts, being a fairly liberal state, meaning we err on the side of the victims, we lean toward the victims' rights, our definition of consent is quite specific and narrow. So typically, consent is currently seen as an ongoing, informed, non-coerced, non-threatened, sober, and verbal yes. Okay? The consent must be active. What that means is if two individuals are in a romantic, intimate situation together and the body language of one of them seems as though she's implying yes, that is not consent. There must actually be a question of, may I do this to you? And the woman needs to soberly, actively, non-coerced, non-threateningly respond back, yes. This is something they train now in colleges. We go through role plays. We talk about this a lot. And sadly, a lot of students still don't fully get it, and they don't fully abide by it. This is true, this idea of active and freely given consent is true both in relationships and outside of a relationship. So that means if it is a stranger rape, then that's outside of the relationship, right? And there should be consent, but obviously there's not if it's going to be a rape. But also in a relationship, in a dating ongoing relationship, technically by the law, there needs to be consent for each act. So that means every time you have sex, and that also means an intercourse, and that also means there needs to be an ongoing, may I kiss you, may I touch you, may I have sex with you throughout the sexual activities. What gets tricky about this is it does not say, even if you are married, but the implication is all relationships fall under this, right? Well, for people who are married, for people who are in long-term relationships, you don't always go through this consent process. right? And so it gets a little bit muddied when we try to then teach, particularly college students, I think of, that you have to ask for consent every time, but that is what the law currently says. Then, this is very important, there are two key times when, in the state of Massachusetts, you are incapable of giving consent. One is if you're under, in Massachusetts, age 16. The other is if you are incapacitated as a result of alcohol or drugs. That's what some states say, incapacitated, which implies drunk, right? Beyond the point of reason and ration. But in Massachusetts, it says you are not able to give consent if you're under the influence of drugs or alcohol. So there have been several cases that have come up where you have two individuals who are drinking, have had a couple beers, they have sex, they break up, and the woman later feels as though she was raped, and charges get pressed, and the individual is charged with rape, right? And that's hard. There's a lot of gray areas at times with these issues, right? And whether, how long you should have to report, and whether it has to be still in an ongoing relationship or not, but this is what the law says. And what I think is important about this is sometimes my students will push back on me, and they'll say, that's not fair to guys. That's not fair. That's so harsh on guys that if a woman's been drinking, then we're automatically raping her, right? And I say it a little more nicely than this, but welcome to our world. It hadn't been fair to us for a long time, to women, right? Because we used to get put up on the stand and raked over the coals if we got raped for what we wore, how we dressed, who we were with, etc. And so some of this is the pendulum swinging now the other direction to say, hey, look, you know, you have got to make sure that you get active consent, and if not, there will be punishments and penalties. So with those sort of definitions in mind, I wanted to at least touch on each of those key aspects, sexual harassment, sex assault, and rape. Sexual harassment, there was a study just done in January of 2018 that suggested that 81, and this was a nationally representative sample, there were actually 12,900 individuals who were surveyed for this study. It was a partnership between the University of California and two other nonprofits, and it suggested that found that 81% of women and 43% of men had experienced some form of sexual harassment in their lifetime. In terms of what type of sexual harassment, verbal sexual harassment is about 77% for women and about 34% for men. Unwelcome touching was about 51% for women and 17% for men. I get FBI updates. I just got an FBI update in my mail about a week and a half ago. There's a rise on sex assaults on planes of women who have drank or who have taken sleeping pills and fallen asleep and being raped or groped by the person next to them. Cyber harassment also on the rise, 41% women, 22% men. And these are on what we call a continuum of experiences, from what one might suggest is relatively minor to a very extreme case of sexual harassment. And all of them are considered sexual harassment, but there certainly is a wide range of forms of sexual harassment. And in almost every case, and typically part of the definition of sexual harassment, there's a power differential. By power differential, it might be a power differential in employment status. One is a boss, one is lower status than the boss. It might be a power differential in one person is rich and one person is from the lower class. It might be a power differential in that one person is white and one person is a minority. Right? So there's many different, it could be that one person is male and one is female. That's a power differential. So that's a very important piece, not only of sexual harassment, but also, as you'll see, of rape and sex assault as well. So when it comes to sex assault and rape, the numbers are ugly. So one sex assault every 107 seconds in the United States. So about one every 2 minutes, statistically speaking. And every 6 minutes, the victim is actually a child under the age of 16. 96% of the victims actually know their perpetrator. That doesn't mean they know them well, and you have to be careful with this because knowing them could mean they work at the donut shop or the coffee shop that you go to every morning, and they see you on a regular basis. So know their perpetrator is quite broad. But 75% of victims are a family member, an intimate partner, or an acquaintance of some sort. 60% of the time, sex assault and rape occur in the victim's home or a home of someone they know. And so most women will tell you that they are afraid to be alone at night in a dark parking lot by themselves. And the reality is, really, where we should sadly sometimes be the most concerned and most afraid is in our own homes and with people who know us, right? It's much more likely that it occurs in those circumstances than in the dark alley. A weapon is used in cases of sex assault and rape about 10% of the times. If you ask women who, and they've done this, the research, who were raped or sexually assaulted, what were you most afraid of? They're most afraid of being killed. It's actually fairly rare that the woman's going to be killed. And the reason is, that is not the perpetrator's ultimate goal. Their ultimate goal is to have power and control over another person. And you don't really have power and control over someone if they're dead, right? And so most of the time, there's not a weapon used, traditional weapon used, and most of the time it does not result in death. 90% of the time it's a single offender. About 60% of the offenders are Caucasian, and about 70% of sex assaults go unreported. That is particularly frightening, because when you see the numbers of sex assaults and rapes that take place, to think that 70% are unreported is staggering. A couple other important aspects, I think, about rape and sex assault, despite what the media and society would like for us to believe and seem to imply, most rapes and sex assaults are intra-racial, within the same race. So Asians will rape and sex assault Asians. White will rape and sex assault whites, and blacks will rape and sex assault blacks. But the media leads us to believe that the most common type of rape, and what we should be ultimately concerned about, is what? What color is the, what race is the offender? The black male, right? And the white woman is the victim. And that is so tied up in all sorts of our past history in the United States and media and cartoons and depictions and Emmett Till, and I could go on and on about implicit bias, but that is just not the vast majority of the cases at all. But when that is the case, they receive the harshest punishment from the criminal justice system. They are the most likely to be caught, and they are the most likely to be harshly prosecuted. Most rapes and sex assaults involve drinking by the offender. They occur typically weekends and at night, oftentimes are young, and most commonly use sweet talk, coercion, alcohol, and romance to lure their victims instead of a gun, a knife, or a traditional weapon. And most rapes and sex assaults occur in the summer months, and we're going to talk about that in a second, but be thinking about, why do you think rapes and sex assaults most likely occur in the summer months? So let's narrow in a little bit on gender and sexual orientation. So this is where it gets a bit tough, and sometimes I feel bad when I teach this, because I have a lot of wonderful male friends and wonderful male students, and my husband's a great guy, and it makes me feel bad. But the reality is, the vast majority of sex offenders are men, and the vast majority of victims are women. So 94%, and this is a number, you will find lots of different percentages and lots of different data. This is sort of a conglomeration of several studies, and I've averaged them together to come up with some of these percents, because there's many different studies that have been done on this. So 94-95% of rape and sex assault victims are female. 98% of the perpetrators are male. Girls aged 16 and 19 are 4 times more likely than the general public to be victims of rape and sex assault. College-age women in particular are very vulnerable. 60% of college-age women have been victims of a completed or attempted rape and knew their offender. I think it's also important to talk about rape and sex assault within the homosexual population as well. We know that about 4 in 10 gay men experience sexual violence in their lifetime, and although the overall rates of rape and sex assault are similar in the homosexual population as well as the heterosexual population, we do know that there's a slightly increased rate of assault committed by gay men toward gay men. So there's a slight uptick when it comes to gay men. And 64% of transgenders have experienced sexual assault in their lifetime. And so typically the overarching statistic that we give is 1 in 3 women has been or will be raped or sexually assaulted in their lifetime. So 1 in 3. Versus 1 in 33 men that will be raped or sexually assaulted in their lifetime. So thinking now a little bit about causes. There are many different theoretical contributions as to why these occur. And I had all sorts of thoughts of going into these with you and explaining them all, but I'm going to focus in on just a couple that I think are particularly important to this conversation tonight. First, let me just say, I'll touch on psychological theories. These are the least supported theories when it comes to sexual harassment, rape, and sex assault. These theories suggest that it's a psychopathological issue, personality disorder, mental illness of some sort, that causes people to perpetrate sex assault and rape. Despite what the president leads us to believe, despite what the media leads us to believe, the mentally ill and people with personality disorders are much more dangerous to themselves than they are to other people, typically. That's just not who commits these acts most of the time. Now, there's one personality trait, though, that we do see that is a commonality oftentimes among rapists, sexual offenders, and sexual harassers and domestic violence offenders. Does anybody know what it is?
Narcissists.
Yes. Who said that? Yes. Narcissists, right? Which makes sense because narcissists believe it's the world according to me. I make the rules. I call the shots. I'm in charge. And I'm more important than anybody else. And they don't tend to have empathy. Right? So we can see why that might be a personality trait that's associated with that. And then substance abuse. And so although there are some studies that suggest that alcohol causes rape and sex assault, that is by and large not the case. It contributes to it, but it does not actually cause the sex assault. Then social psychological theories. This is looking at theories that look at personal interactions. They look at external societal factors. And so, for example, the exchange and deterrence theories. Exchange theories suggest that men rape women because they can. Now, you have to think about that for a second. What do you mean, because they can? Well, a lot of times, they never get caught. A lot of times, it never even gets reported. And a lot of times, even if they are caught, they never go to jail. So they just keep doing it because there's really no big consequence for it. And that then dovetails with deterrence, which suggests that the harsher the punishment, the more severe the punishment, the more certain the punishment is, and the more swift the punishment is. As soon as an act is committed, you punish right away. That when that happens, that you can reduce the number of crimes that take place. So that if we would have stronger punishments, more severe and more quick turnaround on our punishments, that maybe, in fact, we could deter individuals from committing rape and sex assault, but that has not been the case and is not very well supported. It doesn't seem to matter how much deterrence we put out there. It still keeps happening. It actually used to be in the United States that you could get the death penalty for rape back decades and decades and decades ago, right? It didn't make much of a difference. Then we come to sociocultural theory. So these, I think, are probably the most important for us to think about, so I'll slow down just a little bit here for a second and say that these are theories that suggest it is mostly about the gender roles for men and for women in society, how boys are raised to be boys, girls are raised to be girls, and what that means. And it's about our cultural attitudes towards women and what we think of women as a society and the value we place or don't place on women, as well as our acceptance of violence as a society. And so, for example, we have social learning theories and socialization. What this suggests is that boys are raised from a very young age to be tough and don't cry and be strong and be bold and assert yourself. And women, girls, are taught to be more sensitive and quiet and passive and do as you're told and be polite. And if you sort of roll that out over the course of their lifetime, what we're teaching men to be and how we're teaching men to act and how we're teaching women to act leads men to being perpetrators and girls to being victims, right? Then We talk about the culture of masculinity or hypermasculinity and the culture of violence in the United States. And so many people believe that the United States has and supports a culture of violence and has and supports a culture of rape. And what this means is that we not only accept that it's going to happen, but we even allow it to happen. And that our media supports it and makes it sort of flashy and makes it interesting and glamorous, and that the more we emphasize what it means to be a man and be strong and make sure that you don't cry and don't show emotions, that that is actually creating this culture of rape myths, that it's creating this culture of acceptance of violence in our society. And then I'll end with this theoretical perspective, which is patriarchy and male privilege. And, you know, this is always a tricky one to talk about, but we know, and the research supports the fact, that the more patriarchal a society is, the higher the levels of rape in that country or in that society. And patriarchy, the United States is a patriarchy, and we have we have the power often held in the hands of males, although that is changing over time. That's historically been the case, and by and large is still the case. And that also contributes then to some theorists would go so far as to say that the people who are making the laws in society tend to be males, right? And that the judges and the high-powered lawyers in society tend to be males. And so why should we be surprised that the laws aren't that stiff against rape and sex assault, which is committed mostly by males? Okay, so that's sort of on the extreme end, theoretically, but that is, in fact, what many sociologists and criminologists believe and see. So I feel like the time, I don't have a clock. How am I doing on time?
It's about 9.
So what should, how about, how long do I have? I'll rush.
Take what you need.
Okay. So, this is where it's going to get good. So, I've just explained to you all of these sort of academic perspectives, right? And I jumped over a lot, and this is only a few of them. There's many more. But I would think that some of you are sitting there saying, but hey, wait a second. What about sexual drive and sexual motivation and attractiveness of the victim? And what about sexual compulsion? Don't those contribute to rape and sex assault? And that some men are sex addicts and that some men can't control themselves, or that they just have this really strong drive, etc. So I want to talk about that for a second. Generally speaking, that is not a cause of rape. There was a qualitative study that was done in 2009 of rapists, okay? And this researcher went into a prison in California, interviewed rapists, and asked the rapist, why did you pick the woman that you picked, right? And what most people would think would be that their response would be what she was wearing, she was pretty, she was this, she was that. And instead, the vast majority of rapists said, because she was the first available, right? So this idea that it's actually being driven by what the person is wearing or an uncontrollable sexual urge is not true. If it were true, men would be raping women at dinner tables. They'd be raping women walking down the street if it was uncontrollable, right? But they don't. They rape them in the dark of night. They rape them in their homes. They rape them when nobody's around. Additionally, if it were true that it was about what the woman was wearing, women would be being raped on the beach. And the women in bikinis would get raped more, and the women in full clothes would get raped less. And we know that doesn't happen either. So this is not the case. This does not hold up research-wise. Pornography, this is an interesting one. So there has not been a clearly defined association based on research and data between rape and pornography. Okay, it's somewhat controversial. So we cannot say that viewing pornography leads someone to sexually assault or leads someone to be a rapist. That's not the case. But what we can say is bad enough that there have been many studies, well over 100 studies in the last 20 years, that link violent pornography, otherwise referred to as hardcore pornography. This is when there's a violent act being done to the woman. This is when she's in some sort of submissive, compromising position, or maybe she's shackled or she's bound in some way in the pornographic material, okay? So over 100 studies have found that hardcore porn does in fact influence sexual arousal, as well as increases beliefs in rape myths, increases violent sexual fantasies, increases callousness towards rape and rape victims, and increases the severity of injury inflicted during female battering. Okay? So a lot of times when I teach this in the classroom, the guys are like, see, we knew pornography and, you know, rape weren't linked. It's like, yeah, but there's a lot of bad stuff it's linked to, right? Even if you can't make the direct correlation that it's linked to rape, it's definitely linked to a lot of negative outcomes. Then, what about presentation of self? So this is where we think about, what about how the woman carries herself? What about the language she uses? What if she's over-sexualized? Or what if she wears skimpy clothes and she, has big breasts and she exposes them and shows, you know, these off? Doesn't that contribute to, or doesn't that lead to rape or make her more likely to be a victim of rape? So to this, I have a couple of things to say. In fact, as we know from a couple of studies that have been done, it's not about what the woman looks like or what she's wearing or what she's saying. It's about whether or not the rapist thinks he can pull off a rape of her at the time. And it's also not about what she wears or her persona, because if that were the case, then women who fully dress in clothes would not be being raped, and women who dress in very few clothes would be being raped, right? And we know that that doesn't hold up. And so remember back when I said to you rape and sex assault is most likely to occur in the summer months? So I often use that as a trick question in my classroom, and I ask people, why do you think that is? And one of the very common answers is because women have less clothing on in the summer, right? That actually has nothing to do with it. And actually the way I usually say it is, why is it that rape increases as ice cream sales increases? That's the way I present it to them. Right? And they eventually get to, oh, summer because the women aren't wearing as much clothing. But no, that's not it. It's the fact that people tend to drink more in the summer. It's the fact that you leave your doors open and your windows open in the summer. You tend to spend more time with family. And remember, family are the ones and acquaintances are the ones that are more likely to sexually assault and rape you. So it's not about what the woman is wearing. And the reason I feel particularly strongly about this is this ends up putting the blame on the woman, as if the woman can control whether or not she gets raped. And so subconscious... Sorry? Don't get me started. So it's not... I lost my train of thought. Yeah, it's not what she's wearing that is causing this to happen, because that leads us to victim blaming, where what we're implying is if you only would have dressed differently, you wouldn't have been raped. And guess what? That's not what the rapists are saying. They're saying it had nothing to do with what you're wearing, right? So it has zero to do with what she's actually wearing. And another reason this drives me nuts is if I thought that it were about what women wore, I would dress head to toe covered in clothing every day. And it leads you to believe that you won't get raped as long as you dress conservatively. And guess what? It's not true. And so it gives you a false sense of security that I think is really dangerous. So in addition to victim blaming, it lets you believe that somehow you're safe from this as long as you dress properly, right? And what that is an attempt to control something that we actually can't control. So we wish that we could control whether we get raped or not, right? Most women will tell you, if they're really honest with you, the biggest fear in life is being raped. Mm-hmm. Almost more than being killed. Often more than being killed. And if you feel out of control about something, you want to control it. And so we hold on to this clothing thing as a way of making ourselves feel like, well, maybe there's some way I can protect myself. Mm-hmm. And it's not true. Now, lifestyle. This is where I give a little tip of the hat to some of this. So, is it true that the riskier lifestyle you live, the more vulnerable you are to being a victim of a crime? Yes, that is true. So what does risky lifestyle mean? Prostitutes, they live a very risky lifestyle. right? They are very vulnerable to crime, rape, sex assault, and murder. Risky lifestyle. If you use drugs, if you hang around with people who use drugs, if you are addicted to drugs, that's a riskier lifestyle. That makes you more vulnerable to rape and sex assault. That also puts you in contact with people who potentially have committed crimes, are criminals, etc. And so that puts you at more risk. If you are a heavy drinker, and if you drink and are not cautious about who you're out with, if you go home alone with men you don't know, those are lifestyle choices that can, in fact, put you at more risk, and that can increase your likeliness of being raped or sexually assaulted. But in all of those cases, it doesn't mean it's your fault. It just means it puts you at more risk, right? And it means that, you know, it is still the fault of, and the blame goes on the perpetrator, yet there are ways in which we can mitigate, to some extent, some of these risky life choices in some ways. So ultimately, it's about power and control. That's what rape and sex assault and sexual harassment are about, an insatiable drive and need for power and control. And for various reasons, that tends to be something that men are more desirous of and have been taught to be more desirous of than women. And these are common characteristics of perpetrators. This is not always the case, but you can see in here some of what we've been talking about, the patriarchal mindset or authoritarian personality, right? And even low self-image and low self-esteem. Most perpetrators of sex assault and rape have very low self-esteem, right? And they are trying to assert themselves and feel better and more powerful by doing what they do. And also, they have a tendency, individuals who commit these crimes, to minimize what they do. Think about sexual harassment. Minimize what they do, justify it, and deny it. Didn't really hurt anybody. I just told a dirty joke. It's not really sexual harassment. Well, she was telling jokes too, so I just told another joke. It might happen to be in a sexual in nature. Or deny it altogether. It didn't really hurt her, right? She's tough. She can take it. So, in closing, I think a sobering statistic is, despite the numbers I've given you about rape and sex assault and sexual harassment, we know that 50% of crimes as a whole go unreported. They're never discussed, never accounted for, never considered in our data and statistics. And that number increases for rape and sex assault. It goes up to about 70%, we believe, of rape and sex assault that goes unreported. Sexual harassment, we just don't know. There's no real hard data yet on what percent is reported versus unreported. Yet I would agree with Mary Frances. I don't know if I have a single friend, female friend, who hasn't been sexually harassed. I mean, I know I have, both working in the prison, working in academia, working in a office building. So we don't know how much is unreported, but much of it. About 3% of rapists ever end up incarcerated. Right? About 97% of rapists actually go free and are never even charged with a crime or never end up going to prison. Why don't women report? Mary Frances started talking about this a little bit. The biggest reason is fear. When I think back to why I didn't report, fear of losing my job, self-doubt, did I somehow contribute to that? Did I somehow give that guy the wrong impression? Will I lose my job if I report my boss asks me if I wear underwear? And also harm, physical harm or death. So that also can be a driving factor, especially when it comes to rape and sex assault, that women are afraid. And also they blame themselves and they question their own judgment and they don't believe that people or the police will believe them. And they're too embarrassed to admit that this has happened to them, because it also makes you feel vulnerable. And it also makes you feel as if somehow you did something wrong or that you should have been able to stop this, especially if you are an independent, strong woman. Why couldn't you have, how did you let yourself get in this situation, right? And another really tricky one is oftentimes the person's actually in love with the perpetrator, right? And so that makes it all the more difficult to report. So in closing, This is where I think much of our focus, especially as Christians, because as human beings, should really be, is on the consequences of these crimes. So these crimes destroy lives. And they financially impact and destroy people. They physically impact and harm people, tangibly, intangibly. And the mental and emotional consequences are really quite overwhelming. So someone who has been sexually assaulted or raped is 3 times more likely to suffer from depression in their lifetime, 6 times more likely to be diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, 13 times more likely to abuse alcohol in their lifetime, 26 times more likely to abuse drugs in their lifetime, and 4 times as likely to think about killing themselves. There is intense guilt and self-doubt that often comes with being the victim of rape or sex assault or sexual harassment. Why didn't I do this? How could I let myself have gotten into this situation? Why did this person choose me? One of my favorite moments in teaching this material to students is after I give a couple lectures on rape or sex assault or domestic violence is when I get the knock on my door from, you know, the big, burly 20-year-old guy who comes in and sits down and tears start pouring down his face and he says, you know, I always thought it was something I did, but you made me realize it wasn't just me, that other guys have been sexually assaulted and other guys have been raped and it's not just me. And when that happens, to allow someone to recognize and to realize that it's not just them and it's not something that they did, I think it can be a very freeing moment. Prolonged fear, anxieties, and then also just self-esteem issues and long-term adjustment issues and difficulties in intimate relationships as well.
You guys okay? Go for a few more minutes. Okay, so Janice just gave you a lot. I'm just going to talk a little bit, yeah, that's great, thank you, about where we come at this from the church and where we come at this as Christians. Along with Me Too and Time's Up, I mentioned this hashtag Church Too. The church is not immune to this. The Protestant church watched from afar in the early 90s as the Catholic church went through a huge sex scandal, especially in the Boston area. But Church Too has now served as sort of a floodlight on the problems of misogyny and harassment that also exist in the Protestant church as well. The evangelical church especially has some major issues with sex. Anyone outside of the evangelical church, kind of what they would associate with it are issues around abortion and issues around premarital sex and homosexuality. That's kind of what people know. And those are all things that are tied in with sex. But inside the church, we are very willing to call out others and hold others to a certain standard when it comes to sexual sin that we're not requiring of ourselves internally. This is deeply problematic. Primarily, one of the primary reasons is because it's a terrible witness of the gospel to the watching world. If you do a search for Church Too on Twitter, you'll find stories involving victims being ignored at best and shamed and shunned at worst. While time and time again, the perpetrators, who are very often pastors or elders or respected members of the church community, are defended or excused. Several months ago, a pastor named Andy Savage, who's a pastor at a megachurch in Memphis, Tennessee, he confessed to his congregation that he had sexually assaulted a teenage girl in his youth group when he was a youth pastor at a different church about 15 years prior. The video of his confession went viral primarily because his confession was met by a standing ovation by his congregation, as well as a pat on the back, both literally and figuratively, by the senior pastor who was standing on stage with him. But the victim was shamed and belittled by the same senior pastor who's not in that church community. He's since stepped down from that church, but it's a really common thing. More recently, sexual harassment charges against Willow Creek megachurch pastor Bill Hybels have come to light, he was planning to retire this fall anyway. He's moved that up and he's already retired. But the reason I bring that one up is because the board of elders at Willow Creek, they've only just started looking into these allegations, but the board of elders has already come forward with their own apology, saying that when the accusations against Hybels originally came to light, they dealt with the situation in a way that protected Hybels and cast doubt on the testimonies of the women who were coming forward. Just this week, folks. Paige Patterson was removed as the president of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary after numerous recordings and reports surfaced where he made inappropriate comments to young women and encouraged women to stay in abusive marriages.
Stay in abusive marriages.
Some of you may have read this. Just a few weeks ago, women's Bible teacher Beth Moore, she's a Bible study author and a teacher, wrote an article on her ministry's blog calling out the misogyny that she's encountered through her ministry career. And I just want to read part of this. So I've kind of cut and pasted a little bit of this excerpt from her. She said, "I accepted the peculiarities accompanying female leadership in a conservative Christian world because I chose to believe that, whether or not some of the actions and attitudes seemed godly to me, they were rooted in deep convictions based on passages from 1 Timothy and 1 Corinthians. Then early October 2016 surfaced attitudes among some key Christian leaders that smacked of misogyny, objectification, and astonishing disdain of women, and it spread like wildfire. It was just the beginning. I came face to face with one of the most demoralizing realizations of my adult life. Scripture was not the reason for the colossal disregard and disrespect of women among many of these men. It was only the excuse. Sin was the reason. Ungodliness. About a year ago, I had an opportunity to meet a theologian I'd long respected. I'd read virtually every book he'd written. I looked so forward to getting to share a meal with him and talk theology. The instant I met him, he looked me up and down, smiled approvingly, and said, 'You are better looking than blank.' But he didn't leave it blank. He filled it in with the name of another woman Bible teacher. These examples may seem fairly benign in light of recent scandals of sexual abuse and assault coming to light, but the attitudes are growing from the same dangerously malignant root. Many women have experienced horrific abuses within the power structures of our Christian world. Being any part of shaping misogynistic attitudes, whether or not they result in criminal behaviors, is sinful and harmful and produces terrible fruit." As you can imagine, she's gotten all kinds of responses on this, some very critical, some very encouraging and apologetic. So why is this so often the response that we hear from the church, especially evangelical churches? The church has a pretty bad rap when it comes to women, and this is not just a problem for women. This is a problem for anyone who cares about the gospel of Jesus Christ, because it is a massive apologetics issue. The gospel is only good news if it's good news for everyone. We deal with this a lot at Liberty. We talk about this a lot. I just want to put out a couple of things that I think are unhelpful factors in the church. Everybody just take a deep breath, because I'm probably going to push some into some sensitive places here, but here we go. Okay, the first is the ripple effect of complementarian teaching. I do not want to get into a debate about complementarianism tonight. I'm not prepared to do that. That's not what we're here for. There are good, faithful people who love the Lord and believe in the authority of Scripture who are on both sides of the complementarian egalitarian debate. However, very much in line with some of the statistics Janice gave us, in complementarian churches, the majority of the people in places of authority are men. And the female voice is not heard or at all in some churches, or heard to a much less, a much smaller degree.
Can you say what, I've never heard the word before. What
I'm sorry, mean? Yes. complementarian view of male and female relationships in the church, also in marriage is the view, is a hierarchical view. So it's the view that that men have a higher authority over women, authority to teach, to preach, to make decisions, head of the household, and women have less authority. An egalitarian view was that would be that women and men are more on an equal plane. That's a very, very simplified definition of those two words. But yeah, sorry. Thank you for that. One of the ripple effects of this is that you have a pervasive culture of men always being right, of men always having the answer, and of women being submissive, inferior, having no voice, dominion, or authority. Again, this should be sounding familiar to some of the things Janice just shared. Women in some of these churches and cultures are often not treated as they're fully human in their own right with dominion, and are not treated as co-heirs of the kingdom. We could do a whole lecture on every single one of these. And some people in this room have, that I can direct you to later. But anyway, second one is a ripple effect of modesty teaching. Okay. This is a huge, teaching of modesty and modesty culture that has to do primarily with clothing, has to do with primarily women's clothing, how women dress, and the importance of dressing in a modest way. There is value to that teaching, okay? I don't want to slander it all together. I think modesty is an important topic for Christians. I think we should care very much about how we present ourselves and our bodies to other people. However, what tends to happen, again, we will want the church to look different, but what I'm going to say is going to mirror many of the things that Janice just said, which is that it gives the message that girls and women, by what they wear or don't wear, are 100% responsible for men being tempted and acting out on sexual impulses, whether that's lust, masturbation, objectification, so something that actually doesn't involve another woman, or whether it's actual harassment, assault of girls and women. This is a huge double standard. It's assuming also that women are not visually stimulated and that women don't struggle with sexual temptation themselves, which is so unbiblical. In Galatians, I'm channeling the word of Marty Kies over here. Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit, okay? Paul says, for the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. If you took any of these words out of the context of the book of Galatians, you would think we are describing a woman. These words have been highly feminized in the church and outside of the church. But Paul says this is the fruit of the Spirit for all Christians, including men. Okay? So letting men off the hook for self-control is unbiblical, and it's against the way that God has designed us and what he's made us for. And it's also negating the power of the Holy Spirit. I can keep going. I won't. Okay. The next one is just silence or poor teaching on what it means to be human. There's so many messages in our culture right now about what it means to be human, from robots to artificial intelligence to technology. And the church, and some churches do a great job of talking about this, but the church should be the first place. The church should be talking a lot about what it means to be human, because the Bible gives us so much information on that. And what the Bible tells us that is that being human includes our sexuality, and that we dehumanize women, but we also dehumanize men. When we say that men are like animals or men are like monsters because they can't control themselves, that is dehumanizing of men, okay? It's not good for men, and it's not good for women. The church should be leading the discussion on that. I'm not going to say, Janice already talked about pornography. Pornography is just as much an issue in the church as it is outside of the church. And then the last one is the unhelpful use of scripture. Very often when sexual violence, crimes, harassment is reported in the church, people, some with very good intentions, respond in really unhelpful ways with scripture. So I'm talking about things like, well, Jesus taught us to turn the other cheek. You need to forgive. The way of the Christian is the way of suffering. None of this is untrue, but it's deeply cruel in this situation to respond in that way. I have a friend who said, that her mother, when she was young, once told her, you don't ever have to, and she grew up in a very conservative church. If anyone is ever making you feel uncomfortable, you can leave. If a man ever makes you feel uncomfortable, you can leave, or you can yell at him and tell him to stop. And she was relaying this story to an older Christian woman, friend of hers. And she said that she told this woman, telling her about an instance where a man yelled a lewd comment at her. And she said, you know, sometimes as long as there are other people around, it's safe. I yell back at him. And it shuts them up. And the woman said, well, I don't think your mother understands how we're supposed to treat our enemies. Okay. It's not a helpful use of scripture. Jeremiah chapter 6 says this. Listen carefully. They dress the wound of my people as if it were not serious. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace. Okay? To minimize the lack of peace, the sin, the brokenness is not helpful, is not biblical, is not the way of Christ. Okay, I'm going to zoom through these. But the Bible has some really helpful guides for us. How are we to think about this? How are we to think about this as Christians? How are we supposed to respond? How are we supposed to respond to the problems in the church, outside of the church? I want to give a couple examples from the Old Testament and the New Testament. In the Old Testament, I want to talk about the inherent goodness of men and women. God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. We talk a lot about original sin, but it's important to remember that we have original goodness as well. It's inherent in both men and women. They both have value before God as his image bearers, and they're both co-heirs of the kingdom. The second is the word Ezer. Ezer. This is the Hebrew word for helper that's used in Genesis 2. It is not good that man should be alone. I will make a helper for him. This word, helper, the way it's translated, is often used to put women in a subservient role. But there are many scholars who feel like that's not the most helpful translation of that word. Ezer appears 21 times in the Old Testament, and 16 of those times it's used to describe God, specifically as Israel's helper in a military power and strength. So it's a word that does denote help, but the help of God and the power of God and the strength of God, power and strength are not characteristics that the church is very comfortable placing on women, though it seems like God was quite comfortable with that. So I think God has given women something that the church often doesn't recognize. Sexuality, I just want to say sexuality is part of what it means to be human. Sexuality was given to us before the fall. Our sexuality is not all bad. It's not a result of the fall. It's a good, good thing. And then justice. The God of the Bible is a God of justice. He hates violence, and he repeatedly calls for protection of the weak and persecution of violators. He sees, he hears, he responds. We see all through the scriptures that God is about standing with the powerful against the powerless over and over and over. Okay, New Testament. Stands with the powerless. God stands with the powerless against the powerful. Okay. New Testament. Jesus calls himself the Prince of Peace. That is what he came for. That is what his kingdom is here to usher in. He is ushering in a kingdom of restoration. I think of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the pure in heart. He brought an upside down kingdom where those who are historically weak or on the margins are lifted up. Okay, this includes women, children, slaves, foreigners, the sick, the sexually unclean, etc. I also want to comment on Jesus' ministry and friendship. Jesus taught women. He traveled with them. He used them in his parables. He performed miracles for them, and he touched them. His physical touch brought healing, not destruction. In all of the one-on-one interactions we see in the Gospels, the women walk away from their encounter with Jesus in a more elevated position than before they met with him. Okay, the woman at the well, the woman who was bleeding, the woman with the jar of perfume. They are restored or given a place of honor or respectability. He had close friendships with Mary and Martha, as well as Mary Magdalene and others who are named in the scriptures. One of the very significant things to me is that Jesus not only listened to women, but he believed them. And not only that, he placed them in his story in such a way that they needed to be believed in order for the story to unfold. Why were there women at the tomb? Why were they the first ones at the tomb? It makes no sense as far as that time in history. Their testimony would have meant nothing. And yet, they play a crucial role in the resurrection story of Jesus. Pastor and author Tim Keller refers to Mary Magdalene as the first Christian because she was at the tomb and she was the first person to see the risen Christ and to call him Lord. That's very significant. And also, I wrote participation. Oh, it's supposed to be number three. Just later in the New Testament, women are very instrumental in the growth of the early church as teachers and as prophets. They even traveled and taught with Paul. Paul gets a bad rap, but he taught and he traveled with women. All right, last thing here. I just want to give three movements for things that I think with the Bible as our guide, should or could be our response to all the things that we've talked about tonight. Our response to the presence of sexual violence within the church and how we can go from there. I'm calling these movements because this is not where the church is right now, and we need some movement to get there, okay? And the first is really two that I've combined together, truth and repentance. Scripture tells us you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Telling the truth is freedom. The church needs to acknowledge and repent, not only the misogyny and the harassment and assault that has happened under its banner, but for the part it has played in defending and empowering perpetrators and shaming and blaming victims. Throughout scripture, God is committed to truth. He is truth. Jesus repeatedly challenged people to look honestly at the truth of their own hearts and lives. And to take account and accountability for those things, moving from darkness into light. This is what Jesus was about. This is what the church should be about. I can say more, but I'm just going to keep moving here. The second one is lament. Protestant and evangelical churches tend to be terrible at this, but lament is an extremely appropriate and biblical response to the brokenness of the world, including sexual violence. The Bible tells us that we should lament the things that are not in line with the kingdom of God. Lament is not complaining horizontally to someone who can't do anything about your problem, but it's taking our complaints directly to God, and in so doing, we acknowledge that he is the only one who actually has the power to change something. We lament the sexual sin. We lament the violence against the body, also the misappropriation of power and manipulation and of not protecting the vulnerable. Lament is something for individuals who've been affected, but also something for the church to do corporately. And then lastly, this is going to seem weird, but celebration. I think it's important for Christians and for the church to celebrate things like the Me Too movement. Okay? We should be glad that this is happening because it's bringing dark things into light. It's moving us into a place where healing and a movement toward truth can happen. There's a lot of Christians who kind of don't want to join forces with the Me Too movement because it's associated with Hollywood and all kinds of things. This was an issue with the Women's March. There were a lot of Christians who were against the Women's March because it also was, they were marching for reproductive rights and things like that. But Frances Schaeffer talked about the importance of Christians being co-belligerents with other people. And I think this is great. We don't have to 100% line up with every person and every cause, but we need to join forces. The Christians in the church need to join forces with people who are fighting on the right side of things. And this is an area where I think that should happen. All right, the last thing I'm going to share is just a quote from Dorothy Sayers. This was written in 1938, and it's from her wonderful book, Are Women Human? And I get choked up every time I read this. I'll try not to, but she's talking about Jesus. Okay. I think this is a wonderful model for all of us as we think about this. Perhaps it is no wonder that the women were first at the cradle and last at the cross. They had never known a man like this man. There never has been such another. A prophet and teacher who never nagged at them, never flattered or coaxed or patronized, who never made arch jokes about them, never treated them either as the women, God help us, or the ladies, God bless them. who rebuked without querulousness and praised without condescension, who took their questions and arguments seriously, who never mapped out their sphere for them, never urged them to be feminine or jeered at them for being female, who had no axe to grind and no uneasy male dignity to defend, who took them as he found them and was completely unselfconscious. There is no act, no sermon, no parable in the whole gospel that borrows its pungency from female perversity. Nobody could possibly guess from the words and deeds of Jesus that there was anything funny about woman's nature. I'm going to stop there. Thank you guys for listening. We went much longer than we planned. If you need to step out, as always, with Libri Lectures, it's getting late. If you need to go, please feel free to go at any time. But we do want to open up some space. I'll bring Janice back up here for people to make comments or ask questions. And we'll go as long as we feel like we can. And you can feel free to step out if you need to as well. So, thank you. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. The incel movement? Okay. Yeah, so the first thing Scott said, he just brought up a movie called The Burning Bed that had to do with marital rape.
Farrah Fawcett.
The second one, he was asking about the incel movement. That is a relatively new thing to hit the media waves. It's incel, I-N-C-E-L. It stands for involuntary celibate. And it's a group of men that primarily exist on the internet in chat rooms, feel that they are celibate because women won't have sex with them. They are not desirable to women. If some of you remember a couple of months ago in Toronto, there was a van that ran into a group of people in Toronto, killed a number of people. Just in the last couple of months, the guy who did that, this is how this came onto the radar, was part of the incel movement, and just anger against women and kind of tying in with just the right that men have to have sex with women, and real anger and judgment and a move towards punishment towards women in general because they are involuntarily celibate. Do you have anything else to say on that?
It's a growing movement.
Sure. As far as rape kits are concerned, after the fact, of course, when must that be done? How many rape kits are done a year? And if there is no rape kit, there's no evidence, no witness, how do you go about prosecuting that case?
So rape kits typically, ideally, are done within the first 12 hours, if not 24 hours. They can be done up to 48 or 72 hours after the fact. But most women, if they've been sexually assaulted or raped, where do they want to go? Home or to their family? And what do they want to do? What's the first thing you think? Yeah, to take a shower, right? And that's sort of the worst case scenario for a rape kit. So additionally, there are, although rape kits are fabulous ways to try to gather evidence and gather DNA and so forth, it often feels to rape victims or sex assault victims like they're being re-victimized or raped again. And there's been a lot of training done on SANE nurses, sexual assault nurse examiners, to try to help raise their awareness of what it feels like to go through sort of having a rape kit done to you. It's a pretty horrible experience. It's hours and hours long, oftentimes. It's very invasive, because some of the best evidence is going to come from internal evidence, right? And I mean, it's just, it's, It's more than traumatizing. And so it's actually very difficult, oftentimes to convince a victim to have a rape kit done or to go to the emergency room. And so unfortunately, many times that's not done. Because of DNA evidence and because of DNA analysis, it's getting more possible to, identify a rapist even if someone doesn't have a rape kit done at an ER room, because there's clothing, there's leftover sheets or materials that may have semen on them, or you know, so forth. So that certainly DNA, I think, evidence is helping in some ways as far as being able to identify the perpetrators. But the bigger issue is the fear that women have of reporting, and so they never report. So even a step back from, if we could just get to the rape kit point, that would even be a big step. But many, many times it never even gets to the point of calling the police, let alone showing up in the ER asking for help and asking to have a rape kit done. So, and also you asked about if there's not, so there are rarely witnesses to rapes, right? And so another very difficult issue is it's he said, she said. And despite what the media wants us to believe sometimes, it's often very difficult for a woman, especially if she was drinking, especially if, you know, all of these other factors are in place, for her word to win out, so to speak. It's very difficult, and a lot of times women will choose not to go through the court process. And they would rather either not report or drop the case or just not go forward with it than have to go through that and being questioned about the incident and what happened, and then the fear of not being believed. So it's possible, you know, and it does happen. But oftentimes, those cases, a lot of times don't even get to the point of a prosecution. I mean, you saw the numbers of the individuals that actually go to jail are incarcerated for rape. Yeah, I mean, it's tiny, you know. Some states still have an initial punishment as a fine for a rape.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the initial punishment. So, I mean, that goes back to the whole deterrence question. Yeah.
Nikki,
the 90% of single offenders,
mm-hmm.
What on earth? That is terrifying.
In what sense, Nick? I mean, yes, but what particularly is terrifying about that?
Because you think, well, you know, serial rapists, like people in general, I mean, the idea of like 90%, it's like, I guess what's terrifying is like, I'm going to try this.
You mean by it's just a one-off?
No, it's a single perpetrator.
Okay.
Versus a gang rape or a group rape.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
I have like
single versus married. You were thinking?
No,
or?
Like,
I think she was
first
time.
Only one time.
Oh no. 90% is one on one, so
okay.
To speak.
Okay.
Yeah. No. Sorry.
Okay.
Single perpetrator.
Okay.
Oftentimes with sex offenses, and in particular, I know the number for rapes. By the time a person is actually charged with a rape, it's estimated they've committed between 15 and 20 rapes.
Wow.
So it is not at all often that a person commits a rape and gets caught. That almost is unheard of. And oftentimes, it's an escalation over time.
Okay, that is
One thing I just wanted to say, tag on that I just read this morning, was just a comment. It was on a tweet by a reporter for the New York Times who was tweeting about the Harvey Weinstein thing. And there was a comment that she was reporting that she heard from someone else out of just deep, a deep sense of grief and loss at what if all of this had been taken seriously much sooner.
Yeah.
And how many women, more women, would have been, yeah, but anyway. Heather, did you? Yeah.
I was just thinking about how some of these movements in the evangelical church towards virginity and abstinence can also contribute to this, because it seems like a lot of pressure is put on young women to be perfect in that area. And seeing a statistic like 60% of young women in university have faced sexual assault, it seems like that kind of emphasis would easily make those young women feel like they're unacceptable or ruined.
Absolutely. That's a huge issue on a number of levels. I heard someone who was had gone to graduate school for counseling tell me that she had heard that had a husband-wife counseling team come in and taught one of their classes. They were Christian counselors, and they said that one of the most common complaints they have of couples who come in for marriage counseling is around sexual issues, and it's because this is sort of on the mild end. They're struggling in their sexual relationship because the woman, for years and years and years, was told, sex is bad, sex is bad, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And then there's this expectation that you just switch it, click a switch, and all of a sudden it's okay. It's not so much a physical game as a mental game of something that you've been told your whole life is bad and that you are responsible for preserving. I think one thing that's really common, I'm not the product of Christian education, Christian schools, or even really youth group culture, but I know something that's really common there is in the youth group or freshman year of college at a Christian college or Christian camp, you get the girls in one room, you get the boys in one room, and typically the conversation that happens is that the conversation with guys is about masturbation, the conversation with girls is about purity, and is essentially like, it's your job to hold this up. And there's all this false narrative. There's so many false narratives in the church too about, like, if you save yourself, then, and it's like this reward system. Yeah. You'll get a hot wife. You'll have an amazing sex life once you're married. You know, those things can be true, but they're not true because it's not a one-to-one relationship. So there's a lot of issues there. And then,
can I say something about that?
Yep.
I think that's true. That can happen. But I was a product of Christian education and youth group culture, and I think there are anecdotes that tell that story, but I was also taught very clearly, the message wasn't like, sex is bad, your body is dangerous. Mm-hmm. The message was loud and clear, your body is precious, and to be in a body is wonderful, and be careful with that.
Yeah.
So I just want to say the other side.
Yeah, no, that's yeah.
It's lovely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Really well done.
Yeah, that's great. And I don't want to, I want to be careful to say I don't want to minimize abstinence or, you know, but it's just the way that it's often talked about and presented is unhelpful, but that's a good point. Yeah.
If I could just add to that too. I remember being in a Christian college and talking with girls in my dorm one evening and us talking about the worst thing that could happen to us was being raped. Mm-hmm. And the common consensus among the group was that if I was raped, then I would kill myself. Because it's not worth being alive anymore, because the shame is too much, and I would rather be killed. And and looking back on that, I was like, wow. that's what everybody in the room was saying, and it just shows that something's wrong. Wow.
Yeah. Tom, did you have something? I saw your hand earlier.
Yeah, I'll hold off for a while.
Okay. Danny?
I was just thinking about the socio-cultural causes. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about like the gender roles and the cultural attitudes of women and those sort of things. I was wondering if in Genesis, if in other cultures where gender roles are a little bit different, or a little bit more liberal or understanding, or men and women relations are a bit different, if the statistics are the same or much lower or higher or whatever.
So the United States has one of the highest violent crime rates for developed countries in the world. The United States has one of the highest sex assault and rape rates of developed countries in the world, if not the highest. And where we do see some differentiation, interestingly enough, has more to do with this whole patriarchal society versus non-patriarchal or matriarchal society. And also has to do with enforcement of the laws. And so there are several countries that have much more quick prosecution, as well as stronger punishments, that there are lower rates of rape and sex assault. But the question then becomes, are people just not reporting it? Because the stakes are a lot higher. So if you report that somebody raped you, you know they're going to get a longer punishment, a more severe punishment, so you're less likely to report. So I don't know that there are I don't know that there's a very clear answer to your question, because it's so much about who's willing to report, who's not willing to report, how the criminal justice system responds to it. But I know that the United States is often viewed as having one of the strongest sort of rape cultures and cultures of violence in the world.
Tom. Getting to causes again, Janice. We started talking about a range of things from sexual harassment all the way to rape. When you got to the causes, you seemed to be exclusively with statistics on rape.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, and what you mm-hmm. define as hardcore pornography.
Mm-hmm.
Intuitively, it would seem to me that pornography would have some effect on objectification and at least to the level of harassment. Mm-hmm. And the other one is I have direct experience. I was with a group of men and women who were all thrown into this Boston in the winter in homeless clothes. And the women were delighted they could walk past a construction mm-hmm. site and not be whistled at. I mean, now that's harassment. I don't want to blame the wearer of the clothes, but it was very clear that when you dress as a homeless woman, you don't get whistled at. And I'm not recommending that for fashion either. But I'm trying to ask is that many of the statistics involve rape, but we're discussing a whole spectrum of things.
Mm-hmm.
Start with harassment. There's a harassment culture, there's an assault culture, there's a rape culture, and I'm not sure that they all follow
the same connect?
Magic. They connect.
You're saying you're not sure they connect.
I'm sure they connect.
You're sure they connect.
But I'm not sure that that the statistics about rape and the causes of rape directly apply to the statistics about the causes of harassment.
So the statistics do not hold up to harassment, meaning the statistics I showed you about rape and sex assault, those are specific to rape and sex
assault. Exactly, that's my point. And harassment is one of the biggest issues we have.
I'm not sure I'm clear. So you're asking why didn't I talk more about sexual harassment? I'm not sure I'm clear on what the question is.
I think, what are some of the causes, like when you say, like clothing choices don't make a difference in rape, but does it for sexual harassment?
No,
like,
do those things
change, or are they consistent?
No,
are they
many
different
of those
for harassment?
Are similar with sexual harassment as well. I mean, sexual harassment is considered sexual violence. Like that, it's now considered part of sexual violence. Even if it's just verbal, it's still considered.
No, I know that, but it is a different term, and there appears to be a spectrum here of how violent you get.
Right.
And the Me Too movement has a lot to do with harassment and being uncomfortable in the workplace. So
when I talked about, let's go back to this for just a second.
Hang on 1 second. Yeah, Dick, do you have a clarifying thing?
Just another thought, add to the confusion here. This would be very hard to test for, but a factor that I think we talked about a lot around here is that the whole culture is highly, highly sexualized, even in the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you couldn't, there'd be no control groups that you could test it with.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's hard to imagine that doesn't aggravate everything that you've talked about.
Yeah.
And in terms of permissiveness, and in terms of just the formation of identity. What is a man? Like, we get sex. And just the expectation at every level.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that, again, you couldn't test for it, you can't graph it, but it would be hard for me to... Would you have a similar hunch at least
mm-hmm.
that you can
mm-hmm.
Fill up the figures?
I mean, definitely. I think why did this not switch? I wanted it to switch to this.
Oh,
hold on 1 second. I think I don't know how to do this. Sorry, hold on 1 second. I wanted to try to show you this slide. There we go. When you are to go back to your question about causes of sexual harassment.
Yeah.
So many of those theories, the psychological theories, the social psychological, sociocultural, are also true of sexual harassment, even though sexual harassment is its own unique crime, for that matter. But sexual harassment has a lot to do with gender roles and gender socialization. It has a lot to do with men sexually harass because they can, right? And so a lot of people would argue that our laws against it aren't strong enough. Now, it's changing right now. We're seeing an increased awareness and so forth. But the theory, those theories really can be applied across the spectrum from sort of, I hate to say the more minor offenses, but, you know, a less severe offense, catcalling and so forth, all the way up to rape.
Well, what about the next page after that where you put up sort of straw man?
Where I talked about what about sexual drive, motivation.
Right.
So I would say that that probably is more specific to thinking about rape and sex assault, because we were talking about, you know, is it what she wears, is it, you know, but I think the same is true for sexual harassment as well. Like, I would argue that those theories and those ideas that we were talking about apply all the way from sexual harassment to rape. So pornography, for example, right? Pornography, one perspective is it devalues women. It objectifies women. And typically as Christians, that's the way we see it. Well, if you devalue women, if you objectify women, you have no issue or a lot less issue catcalling a woman. Or, like, for me, when I was in the office and the boss asked me if I had underwear on under my skirt. I mean, those are examples of where you're not valuing a woman for who she really is, etc. And I think, you know, pornography in that sense desensitizes.
I mean, I totally agree with you. That was part of my question. Because maybe I misunderstood you during your talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought you said there was no... That you had a statistic that sort of relieved some of your male students. You said, see, pornography is not bad.
So what I said there was... that there cannot, research has been unable to make a direct link between viewing pornography and becoming a rapist, actually raping.
So I'm trying to ask, what's the connection between pornography and harassment?
I think the same would be true, that there's been no research or data that has proven or demonstrated that if you view pornography, you're going to become a sexual harasser. But if you view pornography, particularly hardcore porn, like I was talking about, we know it does all those other things, like increases your belief in rape myths. She asked for it. She wanted it. She said no, but she really meant yes, right? It increases men who battering of women, etc. So I think that's...
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry if I'm not understanding your question exactly.
Are you okay now,
Patel?
Okay.
Yeah. Clarified if you...
Okay.
Go through.
Hi. So I'm thinking about the church's role in all this, and the church being perpetrators of patriarchy, and sort of interrogating ourselves about how we have contributed to this. And I appreciate, you know, your talk about truth and repentance, lament and celebration, all those things you meant, but I kind of feel like if you're going to change... You have to change the entire fabric of how you see things if you're really going to change, you know, make a difference in a rape culture. And I think you have to become activists. You have to become people who spoke out in a much larger way. Mm-hmm. And I guess I feel like, you know, evangelicals in particular, I think, have really contributed to the problem. And so I'm just... And you know, if you think of the theologies that we read... You go way back, you know, you can go to Calvin, but you can go back mm-hmm. to Augustine, like Luther. Their views on women were horrific. And so, you know, we are building mm-hmm. our base, I don't know if I want to say we anymore because I've got mm-hmm. some shifting going on, but on the theologies written by, mm-hmm. You know, men in power, and many of them white men. Mm-hmm. So you've got this foundation that actually has holes in it that you're standing on, and we're not mm-hmm. I feel like we can say, oh, look what's happening, and we've got some patriarchy in the church too,
mm-hmm.
but I feel like it's so much bigger than that and needs to be interrogated so much more deeply.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's huge, so.
Yeah, I agree. Before I respond to that, want to say anything about Calvin or Augustine? Does anybody want to?
Well, Augustine's not a white guy.
Right, I guess.
I think every... I'm not disagreeing. I just think every generation has things that are blind spots to them, written almost too large for them to see because of their own cultural moment. And I mean, Augustine, I think, I'll just speak for Augustine more than Calvin, but I mean, Augustine radically affirms the equality of men and women in his confessions in a way that was very, very countercultural. In the last three books where he's talking about the early chapters of Genesis. But then he said also things that are horrific, and so I don't know how to always make sense of them, especially because people cherry-pick a line and throw it out there. But, I mean, I think it's important to sort of have a critical eye on, I think, you know, a critical eye on our theological tradition and understand, I mean, both have a hermeneutic of just understanding where they're coming from, I guess, as well. But, yeah, I mean, so anyway.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry. Martin.
Yeah, I was just going to say on that is that all these early church fathers were, their education was Aristotle. Their education, so they very much had a mixture of Aristotle's view, the Greek traditional view that was taught in all schools. I mean, everyone got educated in Aristotle, and he was incredibly misogynist, and I mean, his view of women as misbegotten males and all this stuff. So the early church fathers had a mixture of wonderful biblical teaching, but also this really sub-biblical teaching. So Augustine said some great things. He also said women are not the image of God by themselves. They're only the image of God when they're married with their husband. But, you know, well, I would say that's...
Where did you say that? I'm just curious.
I've got it in my... I can't remember this minute, but...
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to... There are people in the room who know more about that than I just want to comment, but...
I was going to say, Paige Patterson, you know, he was a product of his time. That's what people
believe. Yeah, no.
Let him off the hook.
Right, well, and I think... I think it's... Oh. Right. No, we don't want to. I'm with you. Yeah.
They'll say, well, that's what, you know, that's what evangelicals were believing.
Sure.
So, like... We can't give them too hard a time.
Yeah, right. Well, I think I think there has to be, I mean, it's not going to change overnight. We know that. Christians are very much as we talk about being countercultural and standing for something different, we're all very much a product of our cultures. Right? That is, our culture is so seeped into the church right now in some ways that are very obvious, in other ways that are not. I think the place to start, I think the place to start is to take a good hard look at ourselves and our own hearts and what we bring to relationships, what we bring to our church communities. Are we bringing life? Are we life givers for other people? Are we not? I think that's a place for everybody to start who's taking this seriously. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, all these things that we talk about of, you know, having more women in visible places in the church, you know, giving women some authority in the church. I mean, there's just some churches where that is not going to happen. Again, this is the Beth Moore question. This is the point that Beth Moore is raising, that there's so many people and so many churches that for years and currently are their reason for not having women in any sort of authoritative roles is their understanding, is it's a faithful understanding of Scripture. And I know for some people that's true, but really what Beth Moore is calling out is like, no, this is sin. This is misogyny. I think we need more people like that to call that out. We need more men to be calling that out. Honestly, we need more men to be calling that out. I hate to say that, but we do. I don't hate to say that. I wish it didn't have to be that way. Just an interesting thing. We had the church that we go to, several of us in here, had several members of our ministerial staff leave this past year. One was a woman. And in some of the, she wasn't fired or anything, but she left. And I attend a church where women we have women in the pulpit, women are ordained, women are elders, all these things. And I heard a comment from one congregant in sort of giving feedback to the elders and the leadership of our church. One woman said, I hope as you move to fill the vacant positions, ministerial positions, you will take seriously hiring women. We just lost a woman, and she said, One of the main reasons that my family goes to this church is because I have a daughter, and it's important to me to go to a church where my daughter sees women praying and teaching and leading. And you know, there are just churches that theologically are not going to do that. They're just not. But there are some churches who are. There are some churches that are moving more in that direction. I think it's something to pray for. It's something to pray for sure. Do you want to comment on that? I wish I had more to give you on that, but yeah.
Well, I think that's just like sort of a continuation of this whole conversation. What does redemption look like? So let's say we have sin. Let's say we have repentance. I know a lot of times there's not repentance. Let's say there is repentance. Let's even say there's forgiveness. What does it mean on an institutional level in terms of, like, when does someone get to be reinstated into a leadership position? Or what is there a statute of limitations on these things? The reason I am a Christian is because I believe in forgiveness. And the Bible says that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And yet, like you said, that can be very unhelpful and brought up very unhelpful all the time.
Yeah. Sure. Thank you, Elizabeth. Be happy to. So I want to say that the first thing I want to say is that forgiveness and reconciliation are not the same thing. That you can have forgiveness without reconciliation. I don't think we're ever, as Christians, we're never let off the hook for forgiveness. We're not. I don't know that it's the most helpful thing to 2 days after someone's been victimized to say, you need to forgive. That's not a helpful way to deal with it. But regardless of what has happened, because of exactly what you just quoted, the scripture you just said, as Christians, we're never off the hook for forgiveness. Reconciliation is something completely different. Reconciliation is a process that occurs over time where trust and relationship is rebuilt. That does not always happen. It's not always realistic. The perpetrator is not always sorry. So you can also have forgiveness without repentance. I mean, it's hard, but you can. But even if a person is truly repentant, for reconciliation to really happen, you need to see, because as Christians, what repentance is a turning away, right? It's, I was doing this, I'm not doing that anymore, I'm doing something different. Reconciliation is the process of that doing something different and trust being regained. And that takes time. So that doesn't always happen. I think it can happen. I think we should create a space for it to happen. You know, I don't think we need to just cut it off at the knee so that there's no space to happen, or assume it won't. But it's something that takes time, you know. And I think especially in the, so just talking specifically about the church here, if we're talking about someone, I don't want to have a double standard here, but I think especially someone who's in a position of leadership or authority within the church, a pastor, an elder, a teacher, versus maybe a church member or a congregant who isn't necessarily over others, and you know, there's maybe a little bit of a different standard there, because I think if someone really is going to be moved back into a position of authority where they have power, Denise talked so much about the power dynamic, I think you especially really need to see that process of change and trust rebuilt.
Can I jump in for a second?
Yeah.
So I would say, thinking about church leaders who are the perpetrators. So if you have a church leader who participates in sexual harassment, I think that's one thing, versus a church leader who sexually abuses children. versus a church leader who has committed a rape. I think, so when we talk about sex assault towards children, that's a very specific type of offender. And general consensus from criminologists, sociologists, and law enforcement is they are not able to be rehabilitated. They can have you can control their environment, teach them to make different choices, but that's a level of attraction. As if, just like I'm attracted to a male, a homosexual may be attracted to someone of the same sex. A true pedophile is attracted to children, and the sexual arousal that comes from assaulting children. So can there be forgiveness? Of course, there can be forgiveness from Christ. Can that person stop offending? Yes. But it is, if you leave them in a position of leadership, if you leave them in a position where they have access to children and power over them, it's like putting a sugar addict in a candy store and expecting them not to eat the candy. Now, a rapist is different. A rapist is able to be rehabilitated, and meaning can stop their actions, can change their ways, as are sexual harassers. But I think, you know, in particular with pedophiles, that's a very different category of offender. And there's a lot of research on sort of their sexual orientation toward children, and that's very different than someone who rapes an adult or sexually harasses. But forgiveness, I would say across the board, of course there can be forgiveness, but whether you leave them in that position or not, I think is a very different choice. And also, as Mary Frances said, if you want to stop a person from, say, sexual harassing, then one step towards that is taking them out of a position of power over other people. You'll never completely decrease someone's power. A man will always have more power over a woman in our society. But if they're a pastor, decreasing their power so that they're a lay person is going to cut down on some of that sexual harassment, but they will find someone then who is still less powerful than them to harass. They just won't be the pastor of the church doing it anymore.
I have a question particularly about this, the power dynamic. I recently heard a contemplative Christian leader does a lot of teaching and mentoring and has done a lot of work with men in particular because of seeing like this crisis of masculinity. And what his comment, which I'm curious if you think this is true and how this would play into this conversation, his comment was, because we so profoundly lack rites of passage in our world, and that you would know more about rites of passage than I do, but that like a traditional culture, an experience of a rite of passage involves a powerlessness. And he said that because boys don't have these experiences, they never experience powerlessness, and so they always abuse power. And so that a way of rehabilitating power is for boys, young men, to go through experiences of powerlessness. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, to me that seems very, like that makes a lot of sense. It's like there's an empathy and a respect for power and you know, hopefully some that would fuel compassion. So, I mean, to me that, I'm curious about that rites of passage piece, because to me I think the church has a lot of opportunities there already built into the way that we catechize people, the way that people are raised in the faith, you know, practices that we have as believing communities that could have some of these elements of rites of passage brought into them that would help people relate differently to power.
I wish that could be the answer. Do I think there's something to that? Yeah, I think there could be. I think specifically, I'm not as sure about the sort of rites of passage as I am. I think men experiencing a sense of powerlessness or of not having male privilege could increase empathy. And we know that empathy is a key piece of mm-hmm. these crimes. Lacking empathy, not having empathy, inability to put yourself in the person's mm-hmm. shoes. But I think it's just so complex and multifaceted that I don't think there's any one sort of silver bullet that's gonna solve it. Mm-hmm. But I think there's something to that piece of having them experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm just gonna check in. How are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You're doing
10, okay.
Okay. Yes, Marty.
I'm just struck by the curse in Genesis 3:16, mm-hmm. which I think really he's into this and does point to the fact that this is a deeper problem. There's no silver bullet, which is that part of one of the results of the fall was his prediction that her desire will be for the man and he will rule over her.
Mm-hmm.
An unrighteous abuse of power, unrighteous ruling that was a result of the fall,
mm-hmm.
but which, unhappily, in many church circles, that's the only part of the fall that's embraced
yeah.
as being this
yeah.
is God's
yeah.
church,
yeah. Yeah.
prescriptive
yeah.
rather
yeah.
than being descriptive
yeah. right,
of the fall.
Right.
So we,
yeah.
we pull up the weeds in our garden.
Mm-hmm.
We use healing herb. You know,
we go to doctors.
We go to doctors,
yeah.
but we still have this. You know, power
yeah.
baptize this
mm-hmm.
fallen,
mm-hmm.
unrighteous, power thing. And I think you see, I mean, feminists have documented that pattern in every known culture.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Christian faith has had the deepest impact, it's really been, it has been mitigated, but it's still there as we see in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something we're not going to get away from
mm-hmm.
Until
mm-hmm.
Christ comes back.
Yeah.
And one other quick thing, Mary Frances, on your, well, both of you saying it's not what women are wearing.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jesus' statement to his male disciples that when you look on a woman lustfully, you commit adultery in your heart.
Yeah.
And this was to a culture where women were blamed intrinsically for male lust.
Yeah.
Women were kept separate from the men and from the rabbis
mm-hmm.
because they would cause men to lust. And Jesus turns to the men and says, you've committed,
mm-hmm.
when you look on a woman lustfully,
mm-hmm.
you've committed adultery
yeah.
in your heart. There's nothing, no implication for a woman
yeah.
just asking mm-hmm. for a private clothes.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you, Mary. Ben.
Yeah, I just had two questions or two mm-hmm. sort of issues. One dealing with the question about forgiveness. Not my idea, but something that I've heard many times around here is that there's a difference between forgiving somebody and then re-trusting them.
Yeah.
Particularly in these, just how loudly some of these statistics speak about the likelihood of repeat offense again
mm-hmm.
and again and again, mm-hmm. an established habit, established way of interacting with women as subhuman. And to me, particularly in leadership, I think one of the things that really discredits the Christian faith is using the word grace
yeah.
to apply to, you know, excusing pretty outrageous
stuff
and covering up outrageous stuff out of quote unquote grace,
mm-hmm.
Even to the point
mm-hmm.
of not exposing someone in leadership who's done something really horrific
mm-hmm.
and essentially enabling them to continue doing it. And that's, to me, it has to be a really clear distinction between forgiving someone personally,
mm-hmm.
which Christ calls each of us to do,
mm-hmm.
even as God forgives them personally, in terms of as they stand before God, they're forgiving. The world is between that and then saying, let me forgive you, so remain the pastor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The where in the world is that? The
right.
scriptures say that forgiveness
yeah.
means make sure there's no consequences for someone's
yeah.
sin.
Right.
Yeah.
What? You know, there
yeah.
has to be consequences,
yeah.
and it's a supreme failure of love to the victims and the future victims
yeah.
of somebody who.
And I feel like God gave us rational, functioning brains for a reason. And when we see patterns like this, statistics like this, and someone shows that they've escalated to the point of committing multiple assaults or multiple offenses. And we know that, and we offer them grace, or we don't do something about it, shame on us.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I am a firm believer. I think people who are in positions of power who commit these offenses deserve harsher punishments.
Mm-hmm.
I've always felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
Police officers, church leaders, etc. If you use your power in that way, I think you deserve a harsher punishment.
Mm-hmm.
one thing I wanted to say on that, Ben, I think I had this in my notes and I just skipped right over it, but is this in kind of the category of like using scripture in unhelpful ways, is that peace, because grace, the grace of God is so tied to the justice of God. Those two things are so linked. And so when we are sort of freely offering grace and there is no justice, there is no, you know, those are, we're separating things that God hasn't separated. Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit of John the Baptist. One of the first mentions of John the Baptist, he's like preaching a sermon. He's like, woe unto you, like the axe is at the root. Repent or you're toast. And then it says, and he, you know, I forget the exact words, but basically he said this in Other Good News.
Other good things.
There's some mention of the good news. As if this was like, I didn't hear a single nice thing. But of course they go together. Repent.
Did you have another thing, Ben?
Well, just the other thing about power. I just found, and sorry, this is maybe going in a different direction, but just the, it totally, I mean, I haven't studied the statistics, but it totally makes sense to me that so many of these things would be not so much about lust as much of power, and exerting my will over somebody else. I just wonder if anybody in the room could speak to the New Testament teaching on what it means to be a leader as relinquishing power. I mean, Jesus himself relinquishing his power, the call to Christian leaders is to be humble, to be servants. And so it's some positive, there needs to be more positive teaching on what leadership or what the proper use of authority looks like. In terms of the laying aside some of your strength for the good of the weaker, and rather than we gotta have a sound New Testament idea of hierarchy, and ignore all the stuff about relinquishing your power.
I went to a conference recently on leadership, church leadership, and one of the things they talked about was how most churches have adopted the business world model of leadership. The corporate model of leadership is what we see in most churches today. I'm going to wrap us up pretty quickly. Does anybody have anything they want to respond just to Ben's? Any thoughts on that?
Just a little Dick? Bit. I think one of the main blocks has been that if we open this up and admit what we see, what a bad witness it will be. What a terrible witness it will be. And I just thought, Martin just on the way over here read me a statement of Al Mohler from the other Southern Baptist Seminary. The same theological conviction. He said, we can understand when it happened to the Catholics. But it happened to us who believe the scriptures. He said, the judgment of God. Who do you think you are?
Sin doesn't
happen in your church.
And I think his
indignation and horror made me think, that's the problem.
Have you been paying attention?
That's part of the issue. That's part of the issue.
I have another. To me, a huge knot in this is consent, and what stops prosecution. And do you see any hope for? I mean, this morning Harvey Weinstein or his lawyer said all the relationships were consensual. Mm-hmm. So his lawyer is going to argue that.
They might win.
So. Do you see any, is the Me Too movement going to shift or possibly shift juries and judges enough to believe the women more?
I mean, I do think that's possible. I mean, I do think...
Do you have any hope here? Because it's given away with these well-paid lawyers.
You sound like my students. Every once in a while, my students are like, please, is there any positive news? Like, is there anything hopeful you can tell us? But I do think something like the Me Too movement does give power to the women's voices. I do. I think what takes power from women's voices is when a woman falsely accuses a male of rape or sex assault or whatever. That then brings it. Yes, it does. You know, I think those women should also be punished. I do. You know. But this consent issue, it's a very difficult one because oftentimes it comes down to his word against her word. And historically, his word wins. And even though the laws are changing and society is changing to try to empower women more, to the point now that some people feel like it's shifted too far the other direction, the reality is that, you know, when you pit a woman's voice against a male voice in court, and a bunch of males supporting that, and a bunch of it doesn't always go well for the female.
Yes.
And the male is the judge, potentially, not always, but potentially, it doesn't always go well for the woman, you know? So I think it is shifting. It's far better than it used to be. Rape shield laws, you know, came about, and that is protecting now women's past sexual history from being sort of raked over the coals when she's raped or sexually assaulted. That's a very strong move. And I think we'll see more of that. But I am still uncomfortable when it's a male's word against a female's word, and the question of, well, what was she wearing? Well, was she drinking? Well, why was she out by herself at night? Well, why, you know, that inevitably people still think that. And I would say, you know, men, the more that men can also join forces with women in talking about this, the better. And when you hear your male friends or coworkers or whatever talking about this, the more that you can try to correct and adjust, you know, their people's thinking on this, the better off we're all going to be. And a lot of times, males will listen to males more than they will females. They get tired of hearing the women talking about this, and they see it as a female issue. But if one guy calls out another guy on something like this, it can make a big difference. And it makes women feel so supported. You know, and it makes us feel safer. I don't want to speak for all women, but I do think there's some truth. In fact, it makes us feel safer to think like, oh, some men are with us, you know, and some men are behind us with this. We don't want you to fight the battle for us, but to at least support us in doing that, I think it makes a huge difference, you know. And I'm concerned about this consent issue, you know, in some ways also because now, is that still recording? I'm concerned about this consent issue also because now sometimes what happens hypothetically is a guy is sober. No, sorry, a guy is drinking, the girl is drinking, and like I said earlier, they have sex, it appears to be consensual, but no, he doesn't ask, they've had sex many times before, it appears to be consensual, 2-3 days later they break up, and the woman comes forward then and says, you never verbally asked me to have sex, and I've been raped, you know, you raped me. And that's a very tricky issue. And the rule is now, the law is now, that's rape, period. End of discussion.
In Massachusetts.
And so, you know, that is very, very serious. So colleges can take care of it on their own campus and discipline it the way they want. But then that woman has a choice to go to law enforcement. And if she goes to the police, that is rape. And you're being charged with rape. You know, and so I have a son. I think about my own son. And so, you know, I get why the law is the way it is. Because men at times have raped women when they're completely drunk out of their minds and don't remember anything. I get that. But, you know, I think there's an education process going on of having to make sure that we explain fully what this means and what to do and not to do. And I think what troubles me is that when they talk about active consent, they say it's within all relationships. That's not true. My husband and I don't ask each other, can I kiss you? Yes, you may. Can I do? And that's ridiculous. And so we've got to be a bit more realistic about when do we actually give consent and when do we not. Because that's a gray area. But consent itself is not a gray area. It has to be, you know, consent. A no is a no. And silence is not a yes. That's a big one. You know, and a smile is not a yes. It has to be a verbal, you know, yes.
I work with high schooler on Thursday night at the library, and we had been talking about this. She said, I'm asked for pictures of my naked body every day multiple times. Mm-hmm. And there is a link from her, you know, her lab partner to, you know, her girlfriend's boyfriend. Like, and just the connection of porn and just how normal it is.
Yes.
And so the issue of pornography actually moving to sexual harassment. It was just with kids. And this is in the church. And she said, all of my friends, it is just, it's the same as being asked for a piece of gum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Show me a picture of your boobs. Send me a picture of your boobs. Mm-hmm. Of like, oh, can I have a granola bar? But it's also just because there's no shame. There's no, you know, disincentive to ask. Like, well, maybe. But it's just such a poor, and this is where I'm like, consent and like, just how just the language around that, I just, it's terrifying to me. I'm like, this is not what it was when I was in high school. Like, but just how, oh, it's just normal.
One thing, just a quick thing I want to say, that this is a whole other avenue we could have gone in that we didn't. But one thing we do know from studies is that technology, okay, so screen time, however you want to define that, video games, phones, whatever, we know that with increased screen time, so Tom, this is where this comes back to your question a little bit too of like links to sexual harassment, whatever. One thing we do know is just increased screen time leads to decreased levels of empathy, self-control, patience, willing to wait for something.
Actions having consequences.
Consequences. Mm-hmm. It increases impulsivity. So things like that, there's not like a direct one-to-one link between like technology use and rape, but there is a one-to-one link between things like that and other components that are part of of a sexual violence culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I'm going to give Janice the last word. She has something she wants to say.
I just wanted to say, back thinking about Tom's question, there was an earlier question over here from a guy as well, that I think it's important to note that sexual harassment, one sort of unique aspect of it is in male-dominated professions, sexual harassment skyrockets.
Yeah.
And so within the police force, within the military, within, high-level executive corporate organizations, the levels of sexual harassment are often much higher. And some of that is about anger and aggression toward women entering those professions and trying to devalue, dehumanize, and depreciate a woman's contribution to those professions. So some of the worst sexual harassment I ever experienced was in a highly male-dominated job. And there's no doubt in my mind it's because they didn't want me there. They didn't want me there. And so they were going to do whatever they needed to tell me that this is not a place for women and this is a men's job and men's world. And eventually, if they can harass you enough, if they can threaten you enough, if they can scare you enough, you either have to report it or you leave. I left.
And if you report it, you're
and if you report it, guess who you're reporting it to in a male-dominated profession? Men.
Superior male.
Yes. Right? And so I think that's another really sort of sad reality to some of this, though, is that they're actually, at times, sexual harassment and this violence and aggression toward women is really about women entering into some of these male, predominantly male, historically male spaces and people's lack of comfort with that.
Janice has to drive home tonight, so I'm just going to cut it off for us. We've been here a long time. Thank you for listening.